If you haven't already, explore the many ways to connect with our show. Watch full uncut conversations on YouTube, gain AIA-approved continuing education credits through Arcademy, and make sure to check us out and follow us on social media at Detailed Podcast. This is an original podcast by RCAT. Try the number one most used website for finding building product information and save time and money. No registration is required with RCAT, so try it today and get ahead on your next project. Visit RCAT.com. That's ARCAT.com.
The space feels infinite, and it's really about that long view. It's about seeing all these things. But over the course of a dinner, as the sun begins to set and the lights start dimming down, next thing you know, your world has shrunk to this just really intimate space of just the person across from you at the table. And that striking difference from start to finish of a meal is something I haven't experienced anywhere else. And it's just such a cool effect between that and then turning the lights way down and being able to look up and see the stars at night. As someone who lives in a city, this is just such a different experience. It's really something cool.
This is Detailed, an original podcast by RCAT. I am your host, Charisse Lakeside, senior specification writer at RDH Building Science and fondly known as the CSI Kraken. We will speak with professionals who share their insights into the most complex, interesting, and odd building conditions and the ingenuity it took to make it work. Join me as I pull back the curtain on the building industry and uncover the lessons learned. You'll gain valuable knowledge to help you better navigate your next project. My guest today is Michael Kendall, AIA, project architect at Wheeler Kearns Architects in the lovely city of Chicago. Michael is passionate about creating environments that inspire future generations. Since joining Wheeler Kearns in 2013, he has contributed to a wide range of projects, including single-family retreat homes, nonprofit food pantries, mid-rise multifamily residences, and the award-winning Grainer Greenhouse, a multifunctional space that serves as a teaching tool, social condenser, and production facility. Michael is an active leader in the community and currently serves as Vice President of Engagement on the Nourishing Hope Young Leaders Board. The project we're talking about today is, you guessed it, the Grainer Greenhouse in Three Oaks, Michigan. But before we get started, don't forget to take a look at the project photos and drawings as you listen along. You can click the link in our show notes or visit www.rcat.com/podcast. Set on Southwest Michigan's first certified organic vegetable farm, the Grainer Greenhouse is far more than a space for growing. It's a vibrant hub where food, education, and community converge within a considered architectural framework.
So Grainer Farm was established in Southwest Michigan in 2006, and this was longtime clients. We had worked with many projects over the years. So certainly having a relationship with them, you know, makes any kind of project this unusual all the easier. But this was a project that really the owners really loved education. And as a side project for them, they lived in Chicago, wanted to do something in Southwest Michigan. So creating an organic farm that really focused on the education and sort of the stewardship of the land. They have a lot of different programs here, but it really evolved around a 10-acre vegetable farm that grew heirloom seasonal types of vegetables. Around that, they built a farm camp where kids can come out for 3 or 4 weeks during the summer and learn about kind of how food is grown and sort of, you know, just educate people from Chicago predominantly who really don't know that. Then they also have a dining program. They have a CSA program. So a lot of cool things going on that they've evolved to over the years. And really the impetus for this particular project, we had been helping them really since the beginning back in 2006, had done a number of smaller structures. But this particular project was to expand their dining program. It was currently running out of a very small structure. It was a little addition that was really intended for kind of almost a break room, if you will, for the staff. But what was so cool about that, it was maybe 12 people could fit, but you were like being prepared the meal by the chefs in that space. It was super intimate. It felt, you know, like dinner truly on a farm. And that was really something they didn't want to lose with this new project, but you know, it was limiting. And so that was really the goal, is how do we make this better, but maintain, you know, what was working so well.
I started at Grainer in 2017 to build with Rob and Liz, the founders of the farm, an on-farm dining program.
This is Abra Behrens, culinary director at Grainer Greenhouse and Farm. Abra and Michael illustrate how this multifaceted space was designed with sensitivity to its agricultural context.
So that started in the original farmhouse, and quickly we hit a capacity ceiling that was going to limit the program. And so they had started working on this greenhouse that I'm sitting in now. And the idea is to further and continue to link consumers with how the food is produced. So in this setting, they are sitting literally within feet of where some of their food is grown. So there are two working grow house portions of the greenhouse, and that is both for field production and also production for our meals and the distillery in our botanical grow house. And then we are, you know, 100 yards or so away from the vegetable fields. And the amazing thing about the greenhouse is just how many purposes it holds. So it both is our venue, but it is also where we work all week. So the kitchen team has two different kitchens, a pantry kitchen and a line kitchen, where food is produced throughout the week. And then it is served in that same space to guests when they come in. We are also adding in this year a variety of cooking classes. And the greenhouse is a really special place to hold those classes because they are getting to walk through the production spaces and then into the room where that food is made. And I think from an employee standpoint, you know, a lot of us came up in kitchens where we were either in a basement or in a room that has no windows, artificial light. And so it also helps further our staff's understanding of what it means to cook close to the earth.
Really, the dining program is sort of the primary of a space and what it's orchestrated around, but it really also serves a lot of other purposes. So everything on the farm needs to be highly functional, multi-purpose. So if the dinners are at night, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, you know, what is the space? Could it be used for during the day? So all staff space for meetings and so forth, for the farm camp, having kids be able to come in and, you know, do projects, learn about food, eat some of the great meals that are prepared there, as well as potentially things like seed exchange. So they do a seed program that people can pick up seeds at the start of the year. So, you know, it started maybe as just a simple just dining program, but really as we got in through the programming, it quickly evolved into what else can it give us all the way to the very end, you know, including things like seedling germination and actually doing what you might expect a greenhouse to do, right? And actually have plants inside of there. So yeah, it certainly started small, but over the course of SD grew into what it ultimately became.
To establish a clear and purposeful program, Michael and his team collaborated closely with the farm's owners. They embedded themselves in the daily rhythm of the staff, gaining insight into their needs and shared commitment to a, quote, dinner on a farm ethos.
Probably one of the best things that was going was this was a passion project. This wasn't something that was tied to a schedule or a really kind of tight budget. So it gave us that wiggle room to really work through the details and determine, you know, what was the best use for this space and what it ultimately would be best served the farm. You know, certainly having those relationships, as I mentioned, with the owners early on, we kind of already had a working relationship. So being able to bounce ideas back and forth, it wasn't, you know, that it was a formal meeting that needed to happen. And then it's sort of like go back to the drawing board. It was very organic. And I certainly think that allowed us to get to kind of ultimately what it became. But we enjoyed the process. You know, there was a lot of thoughtful conversations. I think we talked a lot with the farm staff, you know, and kind of really wanted to get their opinions as well. So it wasn't just one or two people. This was definitely a team effort. Kind of everyone at the farm was involved. A lot of cooks in the kitchen, if you will. we often got yelled at by the owner because it's not farm to table, it's dinner on a farm, right? Like it's truly your food is grown just down, you know, 400 feet away. It's brought there, it's prepared there. You know, so much of the elegance of the food is the simplicity just because it's so fresh. It helps when you have really good staff preparing unbelievable meals. You know, that certainly goes beyond anything the architecture alone can do. But yeah, we knew we had a lot going for the project even before we got involved.
Built with a deep respect for the local agrarian landscape, the 7,336 square foot glass structure blends perfectly into its surroundings, standing in harmony with the land and organized into three distinct yet interconnected zones.
You know, the original vision was something much simpler, trying to be much more like the rest of the farm and kind of contextual. As this ultimately took shape and grew with the various programs that were needed, next thing we know, we're looking at a 7,300 square foot greenhouse that I don't think was anything like what we had kind of first envisioned. And it certainly served more than just the initial program needs of the dining program itself. You know, really, from a design perspective, I think the goal for the greenhouse, we wanted it to feel like a natural extension of the farm. We definitely wanted to embrace sort of the agrarian aesthetics that were present. And thankfully, you know, a greenhouse, even though it's a pretty big departure, was still a very kind of common farm topology. So we were trying to define it in a way that felt very intentional, really put our modern twist on the elements, and really striking a balance between something that's extremely utilitarian, like everything else on the farm, but also feeling maybe a bit more elevated. So just from a very high level, this is where we started to think about it and organized it into three main zones. Ultimately, the kind of two bookends became where greenhouse growing happened. And then the center zone was where all these flexible uses started to take place. And really that was done in a way to always surround yourself with the farm aspects. In that center zone, we wanted to insert two volumes that were really sort of these almost jewel boxes, if you will, where the rest of this is very utilitarian. We wanted these to be a counterpoint to that. That could also house all the back of house elements, things like bathrooms and all the necessary requirements for a structure like this. So definitely striking a balance there, but trying to keep it open and flexible. And the greenhouse really became a great way to do that.
Initially, the site was limited in size and constrained the original design of the greenhouse. Luckily, the footprint expanded with the purchase of an adjacent parcel to the farm.
The farm itself is actually quite small when we think of kind of the modern, you know, mega farms. The kind of contiguous main area of the farm is only about 10 acres. And it's been at this point going for about 10 years. So they finally have their fields kind of to this peak optimal position where they're, you know, really producing crops that they like. So when we first started looking at that, that was our footprint. It was sort of to build anything, we had to sacrifice production fields. And that was something that the owners were really struggling with. Thankfully, shortly into SD, maybe 3 or 4 months into SD, the adjacent parcel became available, which was about 2 acres. And so that's really what allowed us to think of a larger structure. You know, originally we were looking at something that was just the dinner program, something much more like the other structures at the farm. But now all of a sudden it really, you know, unlocked a lot of opportunities. And I think we were also looking, our office kind of prides ourselves in sort of cross-pollination, if you will, or just always looking at different project types. And so at the time, we were also looking at a handful of projects for various other things, one of which was the Nature House in Sweden in the 1970s, where a gentleman had a single family home and he built a greenhouse around it. And what that offered was an abundance of light, kind of an additional growing season and so forth. So that was what put the idea in our mind of, well, why not take this dining program, what was a very opaque structure, and surround it with a greenhouse? You know, that ultimately evolved into much less of a building within a building and just kind of a couple of volumes. But really, it wasn't until we got that additional site that allowed that to be a real possibility. Now, of course, you know, new site meant no infrastructure. So now all of a sudden, how do we manage water? How do we manage sewer? This being a septic system, no power and service. So there were definitely challenges moving to the new site, but it certainly unlocked us to, I think, ultimately, you know, become the project that it ultimately did.
The greenhouse itself is a kit of parts system based on a Venlo design from the Netherlands. Drawing from traditional greenhouse forms and familiar farm details like galvanized steel, mill-finished aluminum, and the classic farm all red trim.
So the Venlo greenhouse system was something that really was developed in the Netherlands. For those who don't know, the Netherlands is one of actually the largest producers of food in Europe, and that's predominantly done through greenhouses, obviously with the colder climate. So they have, I won't say perfected it, but they are head and shoulders above most other countries in the world. And actually, ironically, as we were looking at systems for this, this was right when Michigan legalized cannabis. And so there was a huge run on domestic greenhouses. So we were calling around to everyone trying to find out, you know, can we use your system? What are its limitations? And we just couldn't get a domestic supplier to give us the time of day. You know, that was just sort of an unfortunate. But then we were also looking at a couple of other projects in the Chicagoland area, two of which are Mighty Vine, which produces tomatoes. They have about 15 acres just west of the city. And then within Chicago's Pullman neighborhood is Gotham Greens. And they also, both of these use that Dutch Venlo system. So we were introduced, we reached out a company in Holland called AP Holland, really walked us through it. So it's a kit of parts in the sense that they make a whole bunch of different pieces that can kind of be dialed in or out, up or down, you know, to kind of get that perfect size that works for your project. So it's somewhat modifiable, but really it is truly a kit of parts that then comes in a container and then you erect it on site. Now, like any good architect, we wanted to push back on some of those, you know, kit pieces and see if they could be customized, which inevitably led us down a few rabbit holes on the project side. But, you know, it really offered a lot of flexibility that other greenhouse providers and companies just simply couldn't do, and worked great for our project. So the greenhouse itself, it's about 180 feet long and 40 feet wide and 18 feet tall. So a really large structure for what is otherwise, you know, a relatively small farm. This has three gables across the top. It is a steel structure, and the entire exterior is glass with an aluminum frame. So really very few number of pieces. And a few things we were able to do that kind of further tie it back to the farm was introduce things like red doors and red canopies that existed on some of the other structures. But by and large, this is a product that is purchased off the shelf. And really, it's kind of tell me how big you want it and we'll deliver it to your site and you can erect it.
Right off the bat, the foundation proved trickier than anticipated to accommodate the system's design.
Basically, you build a foundation that needs to pitch at a very, very slow slope. This is like less than a quarter inch per foot. And the greenhouse then sits on top of these perimeter foundation walls that go down to frost. That allows the entire greenhouse structure to pitch because all of the drainage happens in these valleys of the three gables up on the roof. You know, the system itself doesn't build that in. You have to design that into it. So trying to tell some relatively unsophisticated contractors in Michigan, all of a sudden we're meeting these incredibly tight tolerances. It was sort of like, you want me to do what? You know, so that was one of many challenges we had during the construction process. But it just made so much sense when we were talking about it from the design level. It just, what we loved about this system was how simple everything got once you really understood how it worked.
The Venlo greenhouse kit also stands out for its cost efficiency, making it a practical choice for the farm.
Surprisingly, one of the first things that we learned was it's significantly cheaper. And that's definitely one of the reasons we were able to go with a larger structure. You know, we went as far early on when we were doing the stick-built design option to get that kind of preliminary price, and it came back quite a bit more than we were anticipating. So when we pivoted to this, all of a sudden we could build three times the amount of space for half the cost. Now, again, that's just the enclosure, but still it offered a lot of opportunities. And I think that in conjunction with actually providing real production growing spaces that could help the farms, you know, seedling germination programs and other things, it just opened up so many opportunities that we continually learned about over the course of call it DD.
Unlike a typical greenhouse, Wheeler Currents embraced a variety of tempered glass, both clear and diffused, to help utilize passive strategies for ventilation, natural lighting, solar heat gain, and visual connection to the farmland environment.
Most greenhouses aren't actually glass. This is one of the few systems that uses an actual glass. So all of this is eighth inch tempered glass. It comes in two flavors on our particular. We have some that's clear and some that's diffuse. Really, that's kind of what this particular greenhouse system gave us, was the ability to do these larger sizes because of that, and just a little bit more control as far as how clear the glass can be seen out to the farm. You know, that's always one of the things we wanted to maintain here, is that really strong sense of visual connection to the surroundings. And what we loved about the greenhouse, it gave us over kind of more of a traditional stick-built building, you know, that has a lot of opaque walls. At the two bookends, where we are just really on one side doing seedling germination, leafy green growth, things like that, we used a diffuse glass. And really, that allowed us, that significantly cuts down on solar heat gain. It also distributes the sun rays more evenly across the plant. So that's kind of the preferred glass type if you're using this strictly as a greenhouse. Most greenhouses you would see, that's what they're going with. So that worked really well for the two bookends. Also in those spaces, we don't have to worry about air conditioning. The systems themselves are designed with passive strategies. So all of the roof can open up and vent. There's high sidewall venting. So we're able to manage that from that side of things. And then a simple gas-forced little heater in the corners can manage frost proofing and so forth. So those sides, you know, not really anything out of the ordinary. It's really that center zone where things started to get a little bit more complicated. Going to clear glass certainly introduced the solar heat gain challenges, because now we went from a product that's designed to kind of keep the sun out to a single pane glass that's 1950s technology, right? And it's all glass. There's no escape from it. And so there, again, using passive means wherever possible, all of the roof opens up with a series of vents that helped kind of keep the stratified warm air. But also in this area, we deployed a retractable screen that had a high reflectivity on the top, so bouncing that solar radiation out. And the key with that was it also needed to overhang down the sidewalls a little bit. The side that faces south was also gaining a lot of solar heat gain. So these weren't things we figured out day one. Some of this was trial and error. Thankfully, they were patient with us. But the center zone had a completely different need from the other two spaces. So between all those different systems, trying to do as much as we could passively, and then really introducing a robust system of active mechanical strategies as well to kind of get us over the finish line. You know, we have your traditional things, plumbing vents. We have two type one kitchen hoods. So those have a giant 24-inch diameter stainless steel duct that go right up through the roof. Anything that was hot like that or potentially combustible, we actually swapped the glass panels with an aluminum panel in the glass system. So that's another nice component is, yes, it's predominantly used for glass, but there's no reason you can't put an aluminum panel, you know, a plexiglass panel, you name it. The system is adaptable to accommodate things like that. So that gave us a lot of options for anything that we weren't able to bring out either through the underground and had to go through the roof. We also have a fireplace. So how do you get a chimney up? So same kind of sets of logic that we worked through. And thankfully, these panels were able to be field cut as well. So that gave us a little bit of wiggle room on how to kind of line everything up and hit those tight tolerances.
The interior spaces support a wide range of activities, from daily food preparation to youth programming and intimate long table dinners. Flexible furnishings, distinctly placed skylights, and a heated concrete floor make it easy to shift between utility and celebration.
I'll say one of my favorite phrases that was used countless times during the course of construction is, it's just a greenhouse versus this is something special. And we always use that term to kind of justify when we were doing something nice and it needed to be elevated using a higher end material or something versus just letting it be what it was. So that became sort of our guiding principle throughout. But you know, there was a lot of happy medium. So I'll start with the floor. It's a simple 6-inch concrete slab, but the owners really love terrazzo. And so did we. So how do we grind and polish this in such a way that you can sort of get, you know, a little bit of that salt and pepper look that terrazzo might have? That was a way to elevate the floor slightly. But at the end of the day, Ed is an extremely functional floor that can be hosed down. We put trench drains at the perimeter, you know, to accommodate, again, those practical things. But always thinking about kind of that practicality and aesthetics simultaneously. We certainly spent a lot of time thinking about the furniture that was going to be between the two volumes as an opportunity. Again, places where people really interacted with and kind of, you know, could touch and feel, those were places we wanted to elevate. So using things like nicer furniture and chairs. I mean, also kind of from an aesthetics, everything is meant to be very clean, contemporary. Even though we maybe are using different materials from the rest of the farm, we still wanted it to be of that kind of vein, very, not austere, but modern warmth, crisp detailing, not over the top, no additive types of things. And that was also a guiding principle. Thinking of it almost more as like a refined palette of simplicity and authenticity to the farm itself. Most of the materials we were thinking about aesthetically were not really meant to be unique or exotic, right? It was how do you use simple materials that are found on a farm in kind of interesting ways? things like stainless steel, that became our sort of trim detail. We used that throughout on corner guards, thresholds, in and out of the wood volumes. That became sort of our liners as a way that was, again, it can take a beating, but it also looks really good if you brush it just a little bit. So kind of mediating those two extremes. And then we always like to introduce some quirky details. You know, it's such a refined and simple space. How can we introduce further unexpected things? So for instance, when you go into the bathroom, there are skylights in there that are round, bubble, off-the-shelf skylights. But the idea is that these are landmark spaces, but if you get some light in through the ceiling, now you're back into the greenhouse, you can get light borrowed through there. Like, it just solves a lot of issues and is a really funky thing that you might not expect. Same thing over the mudroom sink. We have a giant hole cut out in the ceiling there, again, to get daylight in. It also became an opportunity to put some spotlights through there and accentuate that sink. So it was a bit of fun play where we could, a bit of using simple materials to keep things refined and elegant in others, and sort of always trying to balance the two.
By working closely with the Grainer Farm staff, Michael and his team curated the kitchen to meet their every need in an open setting within the greenhouse system.
I mean, this was one we had to really work closely with the staff just to see, you know, one of the things was this was an opportunity for them to put together their wish list, right? The previous space that you mentioned was pretty constrained. So all of a sudden, oh, I can have, you know, X, Y, and Z. Okay, let's see if we can fit those. And, you know, while the building is bigger, the two wood volumes, the one that houses all this equipment, is pretty constrained. So really breaking down their wish list into things that made sense and really supported the farm functions. You know, that was kind of the first step, but there were a lot of unique things. We had two type one hoods that really opened up the amount of things like stoves and fryers and other things that they were allowed to use that they didn't previously. Those really all became really nice to have that the greenhouse needed to accommodate. So how do you integrate those in such a way that, again, don't detract? All of the kitchen equipment is really on display and you see it from the dining room. And so how do you make these things look good and not just be production-based elements? So that was certainly a challenge. It's just amazing how many penetrations a building has to accommodate a kitchen, what types of surfaces are needed to be able to wipe it all down and so forth. So we used a solid surface material that was all fused together to create a super hygiene space in the back. So, I mean, we really wanted it to be both something that was highly functional, but also really elegant because it was on display. So just a lot of coordination. I think I'm going to keep coming back to that word for this project, right? It's just so much coordination on every front.
Radiant heating beneath the foundation slab supports both year-round cultivation and dining by maintaining consistent thermal comfort across the shared greenhouse space.
So this is a year-round program, and maybe less obvious to us at first, dinner is much easier to keep the greenhouse conditioned than summer. So one of the things we introduced was radiant heating in the slab. The key with that being, you know, warm air wants to rise. So how do we introduce heat low, kind of right near the users at the dining table? And so that was an easy solution. The thermal mass of the slab, it's a 6-inch thick concrete slab. Once that gets heated, you know, that can really keep the space warm for quite an extended period. So that in combination, we also have things like a VRF system. There's a grouping of air handling units that provide additional warm air to the space. We tried to layer in all these different approaches to account for a wide variety of use case. But yeah, the dining program is open year round. It's open 3 days a week and, you know, the greenhouse performs for all of it.
And are they growing things year round in there as well?
So certainly during kind of the typical spring, summer, fall, winter, it's a little bit less, but there are some seedling programs that they try to do. Some things like leafy greens are able to. The smaller of the two kind of bookends, we call the kind of experimentation zone or the herb garden, if you will. Those have plants in them year round. These are types of plants that aren't necessarily production types of things, but really are meant to complement the dining program. So things like edible flowers and unique fruits that might be used for particular dishes, that is functional all year round as well.
But no cannabis.
No cannabis here. Yeah. Too many regulations.
The septic field, thoughtfully positioned between the parking area and the greenhouse, serves a dual purpose. Managing well water, filtration, and drainage from the kitchen and bathrooms, while also acting as a buffer that redirects headlights away from the structure.
There are three bathrooms in the structure. Obviously, there's a commercial dishwasher. So there's a lot of waste being produced. So we built a new septic field to accommodate these. And ironically, we turned that into a bit of a design feature. As an aside, everyone parks just north of the structure, and we actually use that mound to separate the parking lot from the greenhouse and use that height as a way to hide headlights. And then we have a really kind of clean slice through the center of that that take you some steps up and through. And then there's prairie that's planted on top of that. And so that's kind of your arrival point to the greenhouse, using that again as an asset rather than just, oh, I have to put a septic field somewhere. You know, where can I throw this? This is a very elevated dining experience. So what do you do with things like well water? How do you accommodate a filtration system? You know, so that becomes something that can be used in a manner that, again, doesn't detract from the diner's experience. So, right. So all of those things had to be coordinated outside of the structure. And there was no existing, you know, citywide infrastructure that could be reused. A couple other things that were a challenge here is, one, the site was limited to single phase power. And a lot of commercial cooking equipment and ventilation equipment requires three phase. So sort of how do we bridge that median? Thankfully, we were able to find equipment, everything in single phase except for two. So there is a makeup air unit that brings in fresh air for the two exhaust hoods that we used a localized phase converter, as well as the exhaust fan for the two kitchen hoods that also needed a localized phase converter. But also little things, how do we bring that fresh air in? That's a 24-inch round duct coming from the exterior. So we don't want to see that through the space. Okay, let's put that below the slab. So that was an early coordination item that goes from the exterior and feeds into the kitchen through then some slots in the ceiling. So that was a unique one. The other thing, you know, there's no gas service. Everyone uses propane tanks out here. It's a commercial kitchen. All of this is propane based. We're using lots and lots of fuel. So how do you, you know, find an appropriately sized tank, and where do you put that so it's not kind of right in front of your greenhouse? So little challenges that, you know, when you're in a city, you kind of take for granted, but all of a sudden on a farm, all of this is a very new experience that is just really not designed to do these types of things. So all of that we didn't anticipate. And those were a couple of unique ones that really, again, caught us a little off guard at first.
I think if it was me, I would paint that propane tank to look like a cow.
The pig is the the universal term out there. Everyone's got their pig in the yard.
The pig.
Yep.
Striking the right balance between the surrounding nightscape's natural darkness and the greenhouse's interior glow, necessary for an elevated dining experience, was a carefully considered design challenge.
Lighting became such a big component of this. One, because the surrounding area is extremely dark, which we saw as a huge asset. But also we have a wide variety of program that needs to be really flexible. You know, how do we produce a lighting strategy that feels highly sophisticated and highly customized for, say, the dining use, but also can accommodate all these others? So ironically, the solution from our lighting designer was something quite simple, just a uniform grid of downlights that have really tight controlled optics and have a lot of adjustability within the fixtures themselves and the lighting system. And one of the more unique aspects with lighting was really the color temperature. So, you know, as we talked a little bit about the two zones being different, where we have production growing, their 3,500 Kelvin light temperature feels really appropriate. It's kind of a commercial space, but then you transition into the center zone, and when a meal starts, maybe it's 3,000 K, but by the end of the dinner, you want to get that really intimate space. They drop down to, say, 1,800 K color temperature, and all of a sudden now it's increasingly warm and intimate. And from the outside, now your space looks totally different. So these are some really quirky things that we just never would have anticipated, but really loved how they came together. One of my favorite things about the lighting specifically is when you start, and luckily I've had the chance of going to a few dinners there. When you first sit down, you can see out the glass, you can almost see for a mile, right, in any direction to the farm and some of the surrounding cornfields and soybean fields. And the space feels infinite. And it's really about that long view. It's about seeing all these things. But over the course of a dinner, as the sun begins to set and the lights start dimming down, next thing you know, your world has shrunk to this just really intimate space of just the person across from you at the table. And that striking difference from start to finish of a meal is something I haven't experienced anywhere else. And it's just such a cool effect between that and then turning the lights way down and being able to look up and see the stars at night. As someone who lives in a city, this is just such a different experience. It's really something cool.
Framing the social space, two Douglas fir volumes house the pantry, restrooms, and chef's office, softening the industrial finishes and helping control acoustics.
You know, what we loved about the kit of parts was how utilitarian it was. It was quick construction. It sort of checked the box of farm aesthetic and durability. but it lacked warmth, right? This is a space that people are engaging with regularly, and we really didn't want that to be the only thing they did. So that was the idea, to bring in something like a wood, something that had some warmth, some character to it, to contrast some of those. And since we already had these two volumes that are really prominent within the space, we thought, why not a warm wood like a Douglas fir? And part of that was fir performs pretty well in exterior climates. So again, we knew that humidity was going to fluctuate quite a bit within this space, as well as temperature. So we didn't feel comfortable doing like a highly refined white oak, for instance, right? We wanted it to be something. So ironically, the material we ended up choosing was from Menards big box store. It's actually porch flooring. So, you know, thinking, well, if it's already designed to be an exterior porch kind of application, it was incredibly cost effective. The perfect kind of fit for this. Really, the only thing we did was we trimmed it to size. It all came in 12-foot length, so we have no joints in any of the boxes or the volumes, which was fantastic from a kind of an architectural sensibility. But it worked incredibly well with just a modest stain to kind of hold up to the challenges, if you will, of the space, or uncertainties, maybe. It's a better word.
The greenhouse was designed to connect directly to the five senses. Views to the farm, produce, and kitchen. The air carrying earthy scents of fresh crops, materials meant to be touched, like unfinished wood and smooth concrete, and taste, of course, as meals come straight from the soil just steps away.
You know, you often think of architecture, I mean, probably predominantly as a visual component, right? We're designing to make something look beautiful or something that you can see and so forth. And of course, that was part of this, right? But we really wanted to think of that as a way of immersing someone in the farm experience. The architecture certainly focused on the connection to the farm itself and that visual, but we also wanted to make it little things like the visual connection to how your food is being made, putting the kitchen on display rather than behind the scenes. Having it so you see the plants, you actually see where your food is being grown. I mean, one of the great things during the nicer months of the program is they'll take you on a walk through the farm itself. So you get to walk through some of their other spaces. You get to walk through the fields. You really make that visual connection to everything. And so it goes far beyond just kind of the architectural kind of what does it look like. It's sort of that connection to the farm itself. So that was fantastic. But yeah, we thought about the other four senses that maybe don't get as much attention. Certainly as a dining program, first and foremost, taste and smell are kind of right there in the forefront, maybe less stuff we can impact architecturally. But same thing, you know, being able to put the greenhouse bookends on the side, when you walk into that space, you smell sort of that, the plants, when you walk into a greenhouse and you get that sort of moist earth smell, like it's something, you know, you just know, like, oh, I'm in a greenhouse now. So that's something that you experience right when you walk into the space, which, by the way, on a winter day, that's, you know, 20 degrees outside, that is a really welcoming scent and something unexpected. Certainly too, removing all barriers for the smell component, trying to do that in a way for the food itself. I would say for touch, you know, we really tried to think about that in sort of a term of tactility of the materials. You know, it's a farm, so there's a heavy level of engagement with your surroundings. And so both touching the plants, removing barriers when at all possible to touch things, but also little things like the first thing you encounter when you walk into this building is an oversized kind of farm sink. It's a bit of a modern take on it. It's stainless steel, but as a nod to when the farmer arrives home at night, you know, and cleans up before having dinner with the family, kind of a nod to that mentality that this is very much a hands-on experience.
Last but not least, sense of sound proved to be one of the most subtle yet significant design hurdles.
In the farmhouse, we had a really hard time managing sound, even with 24 people. Our ears would ring at the end of the night. And in this space, you know, everything from the design of the greenhouse, that it's a three-peak greenhouse, is meant to deflect the sound and bounce it around differently so that it, you know, helps dampen it. The slats behind me all have sound dampening foam behind them. We're using other kind of masses in the greenhouse to dampen sound. And then also, I mean, I think this is the first project where I've ever really understood the emphasis on the detail and how that changes a space. And that sounds like kind of dumb, but like if you look at the wall that's right behind me, there are no brad nail holes in that because they are built on a frame where you could nail, Mike the carpenter nailed the slats to a frame behind it and then mounted that frame so that there wouldn't be a million holes to either patch or leave, you know? And it's like such a fastidious thing that no one that comes in thinks about, but they feel it. And that is like, I think that's been the thing that I took away from this project, of just like how simple design is felt and how laborious it can be to achieve it, but that it's really worth it.
Unpacking and adapting the Venlo greenhouse system to suit both the site and the specific needs of the client and staff called for a deliberate blend of planning, environmental sensitivity, and calculated risk.
I think for us, it was really truly learning everything that these systems offer and how do we integrate them? Because at the end of the day, the greenhouse is sort of the shell, but there's an awful lot that went inside that shell. And you know, once you pour foundations and you pour your slab, you sort of own everything below that. And so how do we make sure everything is coordinated below that in a way, you know, that we feel good? I mean, at the end of the day, we wanted to hide as much of the infrastructure of this as possible so you could really appreciate sort of the simplicity of the design. And that was certainly a challenge because a lot of this, we didn't know what we didn't know, or we didn't know until it was too late. So a lot of this was figuring things out on the fly during construction. But certainly during design, I would say coordinating things like the mechanical systems, penetrations through the greenhouse itself. You know, we have a commercial kitchen here. So how do you get exhaust air through a greenhouse glass roof? That's pretty unusual. So this was really one where having a client who trusted us and was willing to take some risks on these things being kind of somewhat worked out as kind of much as we could during the design process, but knowing that there was still going to be field verifications and so forth. You know, and we really leaned a lot, I would say, in the design process on our digital tools. You know, we modeled almost every component we could possibly get our hands on and understand in the system. In Revit is what we were used to modeling this. And then we used the plugin Inkscape. But being able to kind of really use that as a way to show what this space could and ultimately would look like to the clients became so powerful. Because again, you know, with these sort of really unique project types like this, it takes a little bit of faith from the client. You know, we sort of have the vision, but are they seeing it the way we are? You know, and thankfully, in kind of the modern era of digital representation, we were able to really bring that design to life and ultimately, you know, get it pretty close to what the final product looked like.
Unlike most case studies, the pandemic lent a hand in eliminating strict deadlines and allowed for abundant on-site meetings and well-paced construction.
I mean, this project in particular definitely kept us on our toes. I think one thing that helped was such regular site meetings with the entire team. And I also think it helped that we had a relatively small construction crew and we weren't trying to do this quickly. You know, it was about doing it right. So that helped mitigate a lot of potential issues. You know, like I said, because it was a passion project to the end users, ironically, COVID helped us in a way because this was being built. So, you know, the idea of opening this new dining program in the middle of COVID, you know, we weren't trying to deliver to meet some deadline. So that certainly helped. But I would say for us, you know, it was about coordinating the MEPs early on. We did everything we could to try to get that. But even when we saw it out there, there were so many assumptions that the actual contractors made and how they would do this versus what we drew that we were constantly correcting for. Things like, guys, this needs to be underground. We need to put our domestic supply lines underground. I know that's not typical, but because we're trying to hide everything, that's what needs to be done. Well, that didn't happen. So now how do we create umbilical cords that can get us from one side of the space to the other to conceal all this? And so that was what bore the idea of these two cable trays that run down either side of it that really, I mean, they were truly our umbilical cords that connected both sides of the greenhouse. They housed anything from our domestic supply lines to the refrigerant lines for the VRF air handling units. They solved a lot of issues, and that was not something that was done during construction. So that was a unique one. I mentioned a little bit about the foundations and the kind of the unique slopes that were required. I mean, little things like that, that just, again, people take for granted. Well, of course, my foundation needs to be flat. And you kind of have to take a step back and say, no, guys, like, this is different. You know, this is what we need to do to make this possible. So it was just breaking a lot of, well, this is how we always have done it kind of mentalities with, guys, this is a very different project. And then the underground work was certainly one of the most challenging because all of this is happening before we have any walls in place. everything's trying to be concealed. So how do you ensure that this underground plumbing is going to come up right in the middle of that wall? I mean, this is the case on a lot of projects, but I felt like in particular here, because the tolerances were so tight, you know, I relate some of these aspects to the way a high-end single-family home is constructed with those tight tolerances, but then yet you have the rest of it that, hey, it's just a greenhouse on a farm. So always those two kind of dichotomies balancing each other were always a struggle, and trying to get everyone to make sure that we were on the same page as far as which of those two camps it fell in, you know, that was a good challenge. It took a great team. We had a great team. And that's really how a project like this is delivered.
For Michael, the experience reinforced the value of humility and the importance of trusting in the collective experience of the team throughout the design and building process.
I mean, this was a project fairly early on in my career that I was really project lead on a project where I was the one out there from our office making these field decisions. So I understood I did not know everything, right? I was pretty green, as they would say in the industry, but I also understood sort of what the client wanted and what we wanted and tried my best to fight for those aspirational details and so forth. And so I would say really being able to work with your team and not being afraid to ask questions and admit when you don't know everything. Sometimes we want to come across as, you know, the master old school architect from the 1950s, you know, that has the answer to everything. And that was absolutely not the case here. So having the humility to be able to work with your team, knowing that the best solutions come when everyone really is able to voice their opinions, you know, that was the only way to make a project like this work, because I couldn't be out there 24/7 to say, no, this needed to be this or that. You know, they had to make a lot of field decisions. So building that vocabulary and understanding in the whole team absolutely was the only way to make something like this work, and something I've tried to carry on projects since then.
In all, Grainer Greenhouse walks the line between utility and refinement. It's a functioning greenhouse with a farmer's practicality, but also a place of beauty, intention, and sensory richness, where architecture becomes a vessel for connection, seasonality, and shared experience. Before we close out this episode, I always try to gain some additional insight from our guests about the greater industry. I was curious what advice Michael would give to someone who was considering this type of project, and what kinds of things they could be thinking about early on to help them achieve success and balance of aesthetics with functionality.
One thing I would always say is if you can distill your project early on into a really clear diagram that is almost so fundamental to the program, it's pretty hard to then VE or modify that in a way that kind of completely changes your original design intent. And I think here the diagram was so simple of it's a greenhouse with sort of two boxes in it. Those two boxes are meant to be something special, and the rest of it, you know, could be pretty utilitarian. If you can really identify those things early on in a project and create a value system, that becomes an easy way to maintain those things that are really important aesthetically. And then where everything else needs to become simplified or you're willing to make some sacrifices, you know, you're more comfortable doing so because that's not so fundamental to that particular project. And that definitely was the case with this project.
I really enjoyed this conversation with Michael. I hope this episode sparks a new idea, helps you solve a problem that you've been working through, or inspires the mark that you want to leave on this world.
You know, it feels like with the advent of AI and sort of everything being so financially burdened, buildings have almost become a bit soulless and uninspiring. It's sort of referred to the least common denominator. So I hope this project, as well as other projects, really create a lasting impact in that it kind of shakes you from what is maybe expected or the status quo. It invokes a sense of emotion or something that makes you sort of challenge your kind of daily life or whatever that space might be designed to do in such a way that gets you thinking. And I think we all kind of need to be shook from time to time because it's so easy to sort of go through days in a trance. So being able to really create an architecture and leave behind examples of that, you know, that can kind of instill those types of feelings would be something I would really aspire for through the rest of my career.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode and want to learn more, Visit rcat.com/podcast to see photos, details, and more related project and product information that we discussed today. While you're there, take a look around rcat.com. For over 30 years, RCAT has been the resource for AEC professionals to find the right products for their project. Try RCAT and see how their tools can save you time and money and help you get ahead on your next project. Visit rcat.com. That's ARCAT.com. If you enjoyed the show, you can support us by subscribing, leaving a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts, and sharing this with your friends. Thanks again for listening. We'll be back to share more stories and lessons learned to help you navigate your next project.